Good evening, everybody. My name is Adam Steele. I'm an alcoholic. And I am sorry for being a little bit tardy, so I apologize. We thought we had left in plenty of time, and we could have used a little bit more. So we're here, though. So I've already got the important part out of the way, right? I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic. So that's 95% of it. The rest of it, you know, just varying details. I grew up in, sixth grade on in Stanton, so this is not terribly far from me. I'm of Richmond, but that doesn't really mean terribly much to me. I came from a good way to have an alcoholic life is have an alcoholic in your life, right? So I come from a long, proud line of male alcoholics, right? Just through the ages down to me, just won that genetic lottery right off the bat. So, I heard somebody once say, instant alcoholic, just add alcohol. And I think that was pretty much my experience. I heard another guy say he came off the longest dry drunk he'd ever been on when he took his first drink. And that was probably a good estimation of my childhood right there. I've also heard people, and maybe, you know, it's the context of, maybe I don't know about anybody else, but where I grew up in a home where there was alcoholism already, so there was stuff going on, and that stuff I didn't come to realize until I was an adult. Having said that, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a while now, and I've seen that it really doesn't seem to matter a whole lot what we come from. For instance, I have 7 brothers and sisters, and yet I am the only alcoholic in our generation. Holding out for the next generation here, so we might not have as few alcoholics in this next generation as we do in this one. But, you know, 7 brothers and sisters, none of them have a problem with alcohol the way I do. And so I just figure it's got to be something about not just the situation I was in, but who I am. And I'd like to think it was who I am, maybe without having much choice in it. Because when I had a drink, I had a really great time. And I feel a little bit sorry for people who maybe don't have as great a time when they drink alcohol. My wife might be one of those people. You know, she orders a drink and she takes a sip and she says it's too strong. And I think no, I don't want to have that. You know, she orders a glass of wine and has a few sips because it has a flavor, apparently. I don't know about... You guys might be very glamorous drinkers, but most of what I had, they came with lovely names like Cisco, Thunderbird, Night Train, Wild Irish Rose, anything that cracked when you open it. Ugh. Some grapes had been, you know, the essence of had been near it, I think, but... that's what I wanted, and that's what I wanted from as early as I could get it. I didn't want flavor. I wanted effect. I'm all about the effect. And so I'm glad my father was an alcoholic because it made getting booze so much easier. It would have been terrible to grow up in a dry home. I feel bad for anybody that had to work too hard for it. At age 11, I just opened up the closet and was, you know... a little bit of heaven there. Bottles of every shape and size and description led to some strange experiments. What's it like, creme de menthe or something like that? Good God. I remember I started drinking when I was 11, so I didn't know what this stuff was. I just know I wanted to get drunk, and if I drank enough of it, that would happen. So I remember pouring a glass of, just a straight glass of, I think it was probably Gordon's gin. God, gin is terrible. I remember taking a slug of it, and I developed a system of drinking by 11, 12 years old where I would drink right in front of the sink so that if I vomited, it was a lot easier to clean up, right? There's some manageability in my life in pre-adolescence. So I'm bombing down this gin and then just pouring, you know, a glass of fruit juice and just gin and fruit juice. I mean, so that was my childhood. Things got pretty much as normal as that for then on. But it was great. It was great to grow up in an alcoholic home because it made access and availability right there. And my brothers and sisters grew up in that same home. Not so much of a problem for them. Same access, same availability. So maybe I got the genetics. I don't know. To me, I've met guys who've had horrible histories of trauma. terrible sadness in their childhood. And my father was an alcoholic, and you could say there's the neglect of that there, but loving parents, my parents provided for us, were kind people, encouraged us, were proud of us at every turn. So when I think about it, I've met people who didn't even have an alcoholic that they could really lay a finger on in the immediate generation, but still turned out to be a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know the why of it. I just know that something very curious happens to me when I start drinking. It feels very good from toe to top of head. And I remember when I got drunk the first time, it was off of, this is genius, whoever invented this, box of wine. Whoa, right? We just want to, let's put wine in a big foil package and then hide it in a cardboard box. There is no measuring the level on that sucker, right? It's either got something in it or it doesn't, but it's perfect when you're 11 and you're thirsty. So my friend Joey came over to the house for a sleepover, and I said, Joey, would you like to join me in a drink this evening? I'm sure that wasn't the wording, but when you have seven brothers and sisters, you have two refrigerators just to keep enough basic stuff on hand at all times, right? So we had the refrigerator inside, and then we had the refrigerator outside, which would have gallons of milk and whatever else. So I announced loudly that we were going to retrieve a juice box from the outside refrigerator, and we took out these water glasses and we filled them up with, I believe it was White Zinfandel, Franzia, right? Is that a box of wine company? And that's what I did when I was 11. That was my first drunk. And we got giddy, and we jumped off of furniture, and I think we played a little Nintendo, and then passed out, you know? Nothing bad happened. I'd watched probably enough after-school specials by this point. And if anybody grew up in the 80s, you know what I'm talking about, after-school specials. They've always got a good message at the end. But I just remember waking up and being like, oh, I probably look like a raccoon. You know, that's what happens when you drink. You have this sort of metamorphosis. So I rushed to the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror. I mean, I was in it. You know, it wasn't just the drinking. It was the everything around the drinking. I mean, I loved it from the get-go. And so I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, with whoever would have me, as long as it would go. But it's pretty hard to manage that level of drinking when you're 11 and 12 and 13. I was talking to somebody earlier today. He was talking about discovering a case of wine he had hid from himself under his crawl space. And it just made me recall what I used to do. I mean, I think it must be a little squirrel in me, because I remember somebody gave me a 40 of malt liquor. And I could just imagine clutching it and going down to my room. And I think what I did is I wrapped it up in two or three socks, and then I hid it underneath something. But I just had this mental image of myself, like a squirrel hiding an acorn for winter. Like, here I'm going to dig up this half, this bottle of warm, malt liquor later on for secret indulging. But that's what it was. It was just so much part of what I would do that it began to govern everything I did and everybody I did it with. I didn't have a couple close friends, but we didn't drink from high school and growing up. But a lot of the people I associated with were the people that drank, and we were not friends. They were active competition for whatever we had to divide up among ourselves. That, there's no loyalty in that, because if I pass out, you're not going to reserve what's left for me. You know, you're going to it, because I'm going to do the same thing to you. So I had a lot of transient relationships growing up. It was a matter of convenience. And I got into a little bit of trouble eventually. And that characterizes my childhood. There was nothing really more wonderful to say about it than that. The next best thing for a burgeoning alcoholic, fraternities in college. Genius. I mean, what a wonderful place where you can get an education, I've heard, in universities. And, people find people that they're sexually attracted to and, have Congress or whatever. But I remember for me, it was always, you seem like a wonderful lady, but there's alcohol over here. And I really like you, but if you're around when we're done drinking all of this, then, maybe we can talk. So needless to say, I stayed celibate all through my experience there in college, as long as there was alcohol. I was in a social fraternity in a very general sense. Social meant we clustered around a keg and drank as much as we could. We didn't really talk, I think, to many people. At least that was my experience. But you may have a problem with alcohol when the members of your fraternity are saying things like, you shouldn't drink. And I just remember being hurt, you know, just it really was a really crushing moment for me. These people who drank like me, and they were saying, fear, you should fear the shakes. I remember trying to put a quarter in a vending machine, and it was like I was tapping out Morse code, you know. I mean, I didn't know that that was unusual. I tried to occasionally clean up and look presentable, and I remember before I would go to a college class, I would bathe, I would wear fresh clothing. I would still stink like a brewery, because apparently when you run out of places for alcohol to get out of your body, it just comes out the pores. So, you know, a day or two later, still just reeking of alcohol. And it made sense, because the sober day ended by about 5 p.m., when it became normal-ish to start drinking. And I would drink as much as I had, and I would drink anything anybody offered me. I remember doing such classy things as drinking a soup bowl of Captain Morgan spiced rum. I mean, how can you can be pretty sophisticated doing that. Hey, what's your name? You know, I can't imagine what it must have looked like. You can see I'm not of titanic proportions here. So I was this little wisp of a fella. I must have been 95 pounds soaking wet. And I don't care how big you are, let's drink, you know, because if you have an ample supply, let's shot for shot, let's do it. It was the party trick, I guess, I was capable of. Watch this guy drink. It's pretty sick, you know? So eventually what happens is that you can only drink so much before the fabric of existence starts to come across, you know, starts to come apart. And for a long time, you have to understand, it's been easy for me. This is 1997, I'll say that. My sobriety date is November 19th, 1997. That was... my birthday is in July of 79, so I was 18 and about 4 months when I got sober. And if I didn't have the opportunity to be sober at that point, I would be dead. The way I was drinking and the way I wanted to drink was not for a buzz. It was for oblivion. And blackouts were a daily occurrence for me, and it was just an acceptable casualty. It was terrifying. Really terrifying. I would wake up with bruises and, you know, not know how I got them. I do remember a few occasions where I picked a fight with a JMU defensive lineman. You know, I mean, I can't imagine what it must have looked like, David and Goliath or something. But, you know, I had a bit of an alter ego when I drank. I won't demo for you here, because it might impress too many people, but I would call myself Flex Man, and I would, like, pull off my shirt and, you know, strike Macho Man, Randy Savage wrestling poses and walk around and use my deepest voice and sort of confront people. So thankfully, this JMU linebacker didn't just put me in the ground. I mean, I imagine there were probably many occasions when somebody could have just seriously hurt me because I was probably a bit annoying. Nobody did. Nobody hurt me and nobody stopped me. And I drank and I drank and I drank. And if you said my drinking was a little weird, then I would just rotate one person over. I won't drink with you. I'll drink with you. And in a social fraternity, you get about 30 guys and you can, you know, 30 days in a month, you just rotate through. So within 4 months, I was drinking so much round the clock, I guess I would wake up, you know, by about 11 a.m. and stumble through the day. Everything was a day like this, kind of rainy and gray, and everything felt like a fog on the inside and the outside. It was miserable, day after day after day. Just wake up, sort of rinse, wash, repeat, over and over again. And I felt, I guess the best word for me at the end of my drinking was I felt like a husk. Husk is a good word. Husk is something dead and dried out. You know, somebody had scooped out all the life in me. And what was left was still going through the motions, but nothing was there. Nothing was there for me. And even if I looked okay on the outside, and I'd learned that if you fake well enough, people will leave you alone. If you get good grades, people will leave you alone. If you can pull it together on the outside, then you can keep people at bay a little bit longer. And that's what I wanted, to continue to drink. And if I had been more successful in that, I would have been dead before I was sober. But it so happened that due to a little indiscretion in high school, I was being given random drug screens, and if you drink hard enough and long enough, you can actually fail a drug screen for alcohol. It takes some trying. So let me know, I did not get myself here without merit. So I failed a drug screen through drinking, which I can't imagine, you know, what I must have done. You know, I used to try to time it. If I have a drug screen tomorrow, I'll stop drinking by 10 p.m., you know, give myself at least 12-hour window. That 10 p.m. became 11 p.m., became midnight, became 1, became, oh my gosh, you know, it's 6 in the morning. I just remember swaying as if in a gentle breeze in the hallway, you know, that just so drunk you can't talk, but you're still drinking. That was it. And nothing had changed. I was miserable, and I thought about not wanting to live a lot. Harrisonburg, right? We're not far from it, right? So I went to school at JMU. We drove up James Madison Highway. We are in Madison. I passed Montpelier on the way here. And I thought about jumping off the bridge at JMU. Every day I had to walk across this bridge, across Interstate 81 a couple times a day. And toward the end, that was what I was thinking of. It was my solution for living is I need to stop living. And the only real legitimate concern I had was that I would jump from this bridge and not be terribly successful in suicide. I just thought, with my kind of luck, right, I'll jump and I'll just break a lot of stuff, and then there will be lots of explanation required, and I don't know. Let me just try to drink again tonight. And that's what I did. So my parents showed up, and they said, do you want help? And you have to understand, my parents had been after me, since I was 13 or 14 to get some help. They tried psychologists and counselors and Charter Behavioral Health in Charlottesville. Any graduates here? Fine establishment, yeah. You know, I was 17 years old and hanging out with people who were a lot older than me with very severe problems and thinking it's tragic, and I'm glad you're here and you guys can get some help, but I'm 17. Like, oh, give me a break. You know, my parents are just a little over anxious. Turns out they were right, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for me, because they said, do you want some help? And I tried to lie, and I tried to convince them that I wasn't drinking, which, you know, I'm sure if they lit a match, we would all been dead. But they said, you know, we know you need some help. And my mom, I think, was bawling, and she left the room to get some tissues. And I just turned to my dad and said, I'm drinking so much more than I'm telling you. And it was a moment of clarity. It was a moment of opportunity. I didn't get here because, nobody comes whistling through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Or if they do, we get them on the next go-around, because I don't think they're going to stay. So I sort of washed up on the shores because my parents said, we have insurance, so let's get you in one of these places to dry you out a bit. So I did 28 days in Williamsburg, which I'm a huge fan. My brain was just cooked. I mean, porridge upstairs. I can't imagine what it must have looked like to have a conversation with me. I have a picture. Really, wish I'm boxing up my house right now, but if I can find it next time I speak, I hadn't bathed in like 5 days. My hair was like, you know, a thing of rare and delicate beauty, I'm sure. But that's how I showed up at treatment. And they said, okay. And they dried me out. And about the only thing I really retained from my treatment experience is that they frequently encourage people to attend 12-step groups, especially if they believe that they wanted to stay sober after leaving treatment. And I said, okay. So we went to plenty of AA meetings in Williamsburg, and then when I went back to Stanton, my social calendar, as one guy put it, was pretty clear. I had some availability. I was living in my parents' house, you know, living in their basement, driving their car, eating their food, hating them for it, 18, right? And I went to a lot of AA meetings, and that was how I got started. I came home a little bit past, it was before Christmas, because I started going to AA meetings, and it seemed like I must have been going for weeks, but if I do the chronology, it must have been only a week or two I was going to AA meetings, and I went to the same ones often enough where this guy named Will, popped up on his radar. Who's this kid? You know, they said I looked like a choir boy. I think the first time they invited me to come hang out with them, I was wearing a sweater vest and a tie. I just come from church, right? But I don't think that I didn't know if they thought that I had a problem or not. I knew I had a problem by then. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous had to convince me at that point that I had a problem. I knew I had a problem. John Barleycorn had done a wonderful job advocating for the necessity of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you guys had tried to encourage me about why I really need it, I was tone deaf for that. May be true for you. When I had been a guest of the Commonwealth of Virginia in 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 17, due to that same indiscretion, and when I went to AA meetings when I was 17, I knew I wasn't like you. It was probably a room full of loving, kind people with some even younger ones sprinkled in, but by and large, I would look at the sea of faces and I would be able to say, you know, no, I'm not like you. I'm very glad for your sad little lives that you found Alcoholics Anonymous, but not necessary. And then a year later, with alcohol having thrashed me soundly, I showed back up and I said, what are you guys doing? Because whatever it is you're doing, I need to do. Because you were here a year ago. And a year later, I come back and you're still here. And you're having as good a time when I left as you are when I show back up. You're drinking. And at that point, Verona Big Book Study Group, anybody ever go to Verona for a meeting? Sam said it was like 2 hours away, maybe, hour and a half. Not too bad. It's my first home group, so Verona Big Book Study Group, smoking cigarettes still. That puts a date on it, right? 1997, when you could still smoke in an AA meeting. And I started just going to a ton of meetings, and I popped up on Will's radar, and he kept harassing me. He was asking all sorts of inappropriate questions, like, do you have a sponsor? No, I don't have a sponsor. I don't know what a sponsor is, but I don't have one. And no, thank you. Like he's trying to sell me Amway or something, right? No, thank you. I'm fine. I'm good. Going to these meetings. And then New Year's Eve, coming out of Western State Hospital, New Hope Detox. Anybody ever go support the detox over there? Or had been a former guest, I suppose. Coming out of that, and he asked me again, do you have a sponsor? And I don't know why. Just like I don't know why I told my parents the truth. But I think it's that moment where, with desperation, I realized what I had going was not sufficient for what I needed, which is I got a full box of crazy here. I just don't want to tell you that I do, you know? And I need something a little bit more reasonable in my life. But if you make it hard for me, if you make me feel like I've got to demean myself or you're, you know, condescendingly treating me, I'm not going to ask for it. Even if it kills me, I won't ask for it. And this guy didn't do it. He just said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, I don't have a sponsor. And then I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, let's talk. And I went to Will's house. That was New Year's Eve, turning into 1998, and he took me through the steps. And my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has been that Alcoholics Anonymous as a surrogate for a power greater than myself has been sufficient. Somebody once said, I grew up, I was raised in love, you know, very powerful, loving, conservative religion. It just didn't mesh well with me. I've got nothing bad to say about it. It does wonders for a lot of people's lives, just not a particularly good fit for me. And so you guys introduced me to an idea of a power greater than myself, and the first one that was obvious was G-O-D for group of drunks. Here was a large collection of individuals of all shapes and sizes and descriptions who were having marvelous times in their lives and attributing it to something other than themselves and offering it to me if I wanted it and not telling me I had to have it. That's what I fell in love with, was this idea that what you had, you were just making available to me to choose. And desperation is a wonderful thing. And I had a sufficient amount of desperation when I got sober to jump onto what you had to offer. And Will said, we'll meet once a week and we'll go through the steps. And that's what we did. We went through the 12 and 12. I know not everybody is a particular fan of that, but to me, the 12 and 12 is sort of where I got sober. And it's my favorite even to this day. It, for whatever reason, I know some people detest it, and I'm all right with that. It doesn't bother me one bit, but it sings to me. It spells things out so clearly and sometimes so specifically in my own life. It's a little unnerving that, 55 it was written in or published? I mean, this thing's been around for a while before I showed up, but it does me justice. So Will took me through it, and I think I realized by about the third or fourth step that this was serious. You know, I was a guy who could kind of float through a lot of things on as little effort as possible. But I had a moment of clarity where I realized this wasn't a book report about sobriety, you know? This wasn't me getting the cliff notes and seeing if I could fake enough of the language and sound good. This is about you guys were going to give me enough rope to either pull me up or hang myself. And it was okay by you, whichever one I did with that. Nobody was trying to rescue me. And so I started to take it very seriously. And I did as honest an inventory as I could when I first got sober. I don't think I can really tell you about my experience in the steps other than to say, in the long run, it has been transformative, and I couldn't have been told that in any part of the earlier process. You couldn't have said how this is going to change your life and why you're going to like it. You just said, if you don't want to die drunk, you're going to do this with us. We've just noticed that people that do the steps tend to stay sober. And you should keep a really close look on the people you're attending meetings with that aren't doing the steps, don't have sponsors, because they will also provide you a wealth of information. And that was my experience in an absolutely, in not a bad way, not looking down on people, but I would go to tons of meetings, and I would see people who went to tons of meetings, but who really weren't doing anything other than drinking some coffee and warming a chair. And if they stuck around, they also tended to have some pretty severe problems and didn't seem to be terribly enjoying themselves. And I don't know about you, but I've had my fill of being glum. And I like that we are not a glum lot. I like that we have fun. And some of the most horrible, dirty jokes, which, by the way, I was raised very conservatively, and they make me blush and very uncomfortable, but I like hearing people tell them. It's kind of like seeing something disgusting where you're like, right? Some of the worst joke tellers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's exciting to me because you're saying you're spiritual and you're staying sober and you're still some of the funniest, most cantankerous, strange people I've ever met. And I feel at home. I feel safe. I'm one among the many now. Instead of feeling like the odd man out, instead of feeling like the guy always on the outside, always wanting to be with. And even when I was with, I never felt like I was. Anybody had that life experience? Ugh. That was active alcoholism for me. It was, even if you told me you loved me and we were having a good time, I was not having a good time. And alcohol took that away. Alcohol made that digestible. Alcohol probably kept me from killing myself through my adolescence, and then was going to end up killing me if something else wasn't available. So alcohol probably saved my life until Alcoholics Anonymous could save the rest of me. So I'm grateful for my opportunity to go through the steps with Will. But about 3 years into sobriety, I decided Will wasn't it. It had to be Jeff. So Jeff became my sponsor, and Jeff was an amazing guy too, and helped me in extraordinary ways. And don't get me wrong, I still talk to Will, and I thank that man from the bottom of my heart, and only the way that Dr. Bob could capture, right, when he talks about why we do this. It is a pleasure. There's a sense of duty by doing so that we pay back the debt that we incurred by the man who helped us, and for a little bit of insurance against the next drink. And what Will did for me, he was doing for me because it helped him. And it helped him more than maybe he realized, a snot-nosed 18-year-old kid looking like a choir boy. I'm sure they were putting some long odds on me when I first came in. But I do the same thing. I love sponsoring guys, not because I know if they're going to get anything out of it, but I know it gives me an opportunity to grow. I can't do a fourth and a fifth step with somebody without growing. I can't go back through the sixth and seventh step in my own life without looking onto what garbage am I still holding onto and pretending it's a treasure, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me very specific relief at times. Let me tell you about 2 years sober, first love, right, in sobriety. This is actually probably the first person who's having sex with me, which is why it must have been love, right? I think I was actually emotionally dead. I've got nothing to offer you, but I'm 20 and I haven't had sex yet, so we're having sex now. It must be love. College, back in college, in sobriety, still hanging out with the fraternity because I had no life skills still. So I go back to the only thing I know what was available. They're still happily drinking. I'm going to frat parties before and after going to AA meetings. It was a little bit of a bizarre existence. Guys doing cocaine in the kitchen at 3 a.m., and I'm reading my big book, The one thing that it really informs me about is it doesn't matter where I go, who I'm with, what's going on. If my sobriety is about me keeping me sober, I'm dead. I am so dead. I'm toast. But if my sobriety is about a power greater than myself doing for me what I can't do for myself, there's nowhere I can go. There's nobody I can't be with. There's nothing that we can't do and me stay sober through it. And it's that sense of freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous gives me. Go anywhere. Do anything. Have a blast doing it. And don't be afraid. if you guys had said, oh man, this whole sobriety thing, you're going to have to, you know, hang out in church basements on Friday nights and, you know, instead of going to concerts, you know, I would have been like, ah. I mean, I guess I still would have done it, but it would have been terrible. This is your reward for sobriety, is that you get to be bored, you know, and kind of listless. I think that would have been terrible. But instead, I got hooked up with people who said, you know, let's go to D.C. and, you know, let's go to the 930 Club. Let's go to a sketchy part of town and have a ton of fun. And that's what I did. I'm not wearing a black suit, right? But if I was, I could have on a what they call a stingy brim fedora, sometimes called a pork pie. Think in your mind Blues Brothers, right? Blues Brothers. But that same look is also something that's an icon of what's called second wave ska, which might not mean anything to you. But just imagine a kind of music, a sort of a niche. It was something that got popular in the 80s and died off a little bit. Doesn't mean a hill of beans to you, but let me just say, when I hear that music, it makes me want to dance. And I have such a blast doing it. And it's kind of a funny, kind of herky-jerky dance. I will not demo for you now. But it sings to me. I go see this band in D.C. called the Pie Tasters. What a beautiful name for a band, right? And all their songs are about drinking, you know, and everybody's dancing this music and, you know, the mosh pit. And that's what I did. That was early sobriety for me, was being able to do stuff like that, having the time of my life, doing the things in sobriety which I said or wanted to do when I was drinking but never did, you know, because when I was drinking, I was drinking. That was it. That was the full-time job. Great band. None of you have probably heard of it. That's a little presumptuous. Probably many of you, it's not going to mean anything to you, but a band called Soul Coughing was playing in Charlottesville at a venue called Tracks, which no longer exists. When I was in high school, I had the opportunity to go see this band at Tracks, and alcohol was going to be what was sort of the appetizer for the lovely evening with these two young ladies and a friend of mine, right? So you know what happens, right? I get so hammered that I pass out on the floor at Tracks. And I as the band is coming on the stage, I'm going out. And as I'm coming to, the band is leaving the stage. My opportunity to see this band. They don't play together anymore. But that was what drinking was like for me. Always missing out on the things I thought I wanted to do. And sobriety has been the opposite. It's been a ton of fun for me. If anybody's bad at math and has been furiously trying to do the numbers the whole time when I said I was born in 79 and 97, the sobriety date, let me just cut to the chase for you, because if you're bad like me, you're still distracted by that, still trying to count it up. 34 right now, and I've been sober for, what is that? 16 years. If I said 17, a friend of mine would say, what's your chip say? What's your medallion say? That's what we, you know. 16 years of sobriety. Man, if you had told me 16 years ago to predict tonight, not so much, right? You were going to be in Madison, Virginia, with a room full of people you may not know very well, telling them all the intimate details of your life. How's that sound for you? And you're going to be very comfortable doing it. You're going to enjoy yourself, aside from nearly killing Josh on the way over here. Josh at one point said, that doesn't have a guardrail. We're coming up on one of these turns. We appreciate our lives a little bit more in sobriety, maybe, right? But I couldn't have predicted this. I told Sam the only caveat with me being here tonight was going to be my wife is due any minute. If she wouldn't be mortified, I'd show you the picture of how big her belly is. But I probably, if that ever got out, I don't know if I, that would not be good for long-term survival there. So, but she's tiny and her belly is like just like this. And we've got a three-year-old and one who's due any minute now, another boy. We're going to have brothers. And I think, I didn't know I wanted this. I didn't know I was going to get to have this. I mean, 3 years sober, suicide was still a fairly reasonable, you know, option. Thankfully, somebody said, you know, you can continue to work the steps in sobriety. Why don't we take an inventory, right, before you get around to that thing that you can't undo? And thank God. Thank God for people in Alcoholics Anonymous like my sponsor, Jeff, who would gleefully tell me, 5 years sober, I was getting locked up in the psych unit, you know, and he was able to own that piece of his own history as it helped me not to be horrified at myself and what I'm capable of. Things can get really spooky up here, and it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long at all. Let me skip some meetings. Let me be enjoying all these successes in sobriety so much so that I'm not taking care of what gave it to me to begin with, right? drop back that meeting attendance, backpedal on working with other guys, not be in close contact with my sponsor. Squirrely fast, this guy, right? They say it's a hallmark of cults to say if you leave here, you're going to fail. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has always been people have said, you're welcome to go at any time. And that's made abundantly clear to me is that Alcoholics Anonymous does not need me. I desperately need Alcoholics Anonymous to this day. 16 years sober, I can get plenty odd in a very short period of time. And my concern watching other people is that left to my own devices, if I go back to thinking the way I was thinking, drinking is going to seem like a reasonable option again. And that's what I was told was the definition of the insanity in the second step, was to drink again knowing what I know now. It wasn't the crazy things I did when I was drinking. It wasn't the vivid auditory hallucinations I was having at the end of my drinking, which, by the way, good times, right? Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that was coming. Nothing like those symptoms of, you know, paranoid schizophrenia at the end of alcoholism, right? And that sort of that belief of, oh, my gosh, that would be such a nice answer, right? I'm crazy. I don't have a drinking problem. I'm crazy, right? No, but that's what will happen to me is that I'll live my life back into a way where drinking will seem like a reasonable solution, just like at various times taking my life has seemed like a reasonable solution. And I don't want that. I've got a 3-year-old who I'm fairly certain may be in a sleeper cell of Al-Qaeda. He is a terrorist. And we should have named him Oedipus, by the way. Let me just say, we woke up this morning, and he turns and he looks at my wife and he says, you're beautiful. And he like wraps his arms around her, right? Right? And then what's he give me? The cold shoulder. What's he do the year before? He wakes up and he turns to me and I'm laying next to him, trying to have one of these father-son moments, watching him breathe, you know, this whole vision of beauty, the little cherubic little boy. And he wakes up and the first word he says to me, no! Come on, you know? Doing the best I can here, man. Cut me a little slack. So that's, you know, my life in sobriety is that I went back to school and I thought I wanted to work with computers. And instead, at James Madison University, I became a social work major. And I did a 4-year undergraduate in social work. And if you don't know much about that, that means that you will not be able to repay your education or feed yourself. So I got a master's degree, which just means you can repay your education, but you can't feed yourself. And I became a licensed clinical social worker. So, you know, here's this guy who suicide was up there, you know, active alcoholism was up there, and now I'm doing things like helping individuals who have illnesses like schizophrenia, who don't know it yet, kind of get a handle on what's going on in their life, and to give them warmth and to give them kindness and to provide some information to them in a way that's acceptable for them, and to honor their self-determination, to not take medications, to take medications, to stop taking medications, and to just walk with them through that process. And I didn't think that's what I wanted to do. I didn't see myself as this was going to be something in life that was going to be important to me. But to be able to do it, it's just, to me it says, I say God, it doesn't matter to me, group of drunks, higher power, Yahweh. And I'll say this, atheists and agnostics, I love that we can have anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who can have a rich recovery, do it in your own way. Everything here is free to take. Take what you want to take. For me, like my second sponsor, Jeff, said, he said, Adam, maybe you're just one of these really neurotic alcoholics that's going to have to work all 12 steps. I need it all. And I needed a spiritual awakening. And that's what I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I wanted spirituality. But you made spirituality something I desired. Spirituality with dirty jokes, right? Spirituality with people that, you know, have vulgar language still. I'm very respectful. I'm grateful for the opportunity to come share my life with you. Because it means when I go home, I get to be a father. I get to be a husband. I get to be a member of my family, of my professional community. I get to be a part of all these things because I'm given an opportunity to actively participate in my own recovery. And it's an honor. And I want to I dressed up as pretty as I could and kept the language as good as I could. But you know, for me, God is tolerated as ornery a character as I've ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about anybody who's been here a little while, but anybody feel like even though nobody nominated you or elected you, you felt like you were the six-gun toting ranger in meetings and had to shoot down people whenever they were out of line? I went through a streak of that, you know, where I felt like it was my God-given right to come in and correct people what they had wrong. And that doesn't go over terribly well. I mean, just and I never got any bigger, you can see. I think one person has invited me to step outside of an AA meeting since I've been here, but I elected to remain inside. But I've been able to get through stuff like that, and God will use me in whatever way that I can be useful. So professionally, this is what I'm doing. My family, this is what I'm doing. And I don't know what direction in life is going to take. I don't know what pain is coming. And I know pain is coming. And I know what you guys have taught me is that when it comes, you get to have the dignity and the grace to walk through that pain and remain sober and to use all that experience to help the next guy. And I've seen examples of that which are stunning to me to this day. A guy whose name I don't remember, but we would go to Dr. Dockery's chiropractic clinic. Hollis, Greg, anybody know him? Greg D. from Stan, great guy. In the meeting where Greg, it was Greg's big book study. And this guy, big beard, I remember him, younger guy. Well, younger, he's probably was my age now, the age I am now. When I saw him, anybody over 18 was ancient. So had a couple kids and one on the way. And he was in AA meetings. He was dying of cancer. He was dying of cancer. And sure enough, I'd see him in AA meetings, and I'd see him in AA meetings, and I didn't see him in AA meetings because he died. He died sober. He died going to AA meetings as he was at that stage in his life. And for me, it's examples like that. You probably don't know him. It's a guy named JP down in Roanoke, who, amazing guy. He worked for a railroad for a long time. I don't know if he still might or not, but I got to attend two funerals for two of his adult sons that he buried 18 months apart. And I got to watch him be sober through that. And I've got a three-year-old, and I cannot imagine the pain and grief of going through that, not once, but twice. And then on the other side of that, having a rich, joy-filled life. And that, to me, is the bomb-proof stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the stuff you can't buy it, you can't fake it. You do the work and you get it. And while you're in pain and you're in anguish, in sobriety, you walk with us and we pull the pack a little bit closer around you and hold you up, and you get to the other side of it and you have incredible experience that you can share with others and to help them through their own periods of difficulty. I'm young yet. I'm going to lose a lot of people I love. I'm not looking forward to that. I know it's coming. My wife lost her father this past July, right as we found out we were pregnant with number two. And I think that's the way it works. You know, there's going to be periods in my life that are going to be filled with joy, to the brim with joy, so much so that I may not be able to even appreciate it at the time. And then there's going to be times in my life I know that are going to be profoundly sad. I do know the constant that will carry me through is my relationship with a higher power that was given to me as a result of doing the work suggested in Alcoholics Anonymous by people exactly like you. And that's the thing that never could have convinced me this is what I wanted or what I needed. Alcohol convinced me, right? And you guys made it safe and acceptable for me to come back. You didn't demean me. You didn't belittle me. And inside Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that's the kindest gift we can give each other is just to say, it's good to see you. I'm happy to see you. Have a cup of coffee. Have a seat. Maybe what do we want to do different this time? Not in a condescending way, but, you know, it's a process of elimination. If we know what doesn't work, let's get closer to what does. And I guarantee you, if I stay sober long enough, I'm gonna do something dumb. You know, I'm gonna do something dumb. And thankfully, the process of the steps, you give me an opportunity to go back and to pick it apart. I can inventory it. I can take these matters back before God, and I can say, here are things that I thought were gonna make me happy, that I've held on to, that have hurt me, just like my drinking did. You know, the bottles were only the symbol, right? My drinking was just a symptom of something greater that was wrong with me, this soul sickness called alcoholism. I respect that Alcoholics Anonymous has a singleness of purpose. It just tends to work really well on a lot of other problems I have aside from alcoholism. So I really appreciate you guys, through Sam, giving me the opportunity to come meet you. If you're ever in Richmond, my home group is the Sunday Morning Promises group. We meet at some place called the Roundhouse, which is sitting right at the edge of Bird Park. Not very difficult to get to. If you take Boulevard from 64 and just drive until you hit Christopher Columbus and turn left. You're about there. So if you'd like to come, it meets, you know, what, 9:30? Yeah, we did it this morning. That's my memory. I get there at 9. I'll see you there at 9, right? We'll drink some coffee. Don't be late like I was, though, okay? But I love the opportunity. We get to meet each other. I get to share my sobriety with you and go forward in this journey, because I don't know what resources you have. I don't know what experience, strength, and hope you have that I might need, that I might need desperately. Time's just coming. So let's develop some friendships. Let's get to know each other. And if you need other speakers, there are plenty of good folk in Richmond to carry a powerful message of recovery. And unfortunately, my home group is a speaker meeting. And so between Sam and whoever else is in here, just plan on making a road trip here sometime in the next 12 months. Maybe you can meet one of my squalling sons at that point. So thank you very much.